The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, September 28th, 2007, and this is show number 97. I'm Bob Hayes, your host, here this week again to talk about MotoGP. We got kind of an interesting show today. Jules Chisek, a.k.a. Pop Monkey, and myself, we did a phone call talking about the Motegi race and just some of the things that happened with the wet race and all of that. Sort of a kind of a race report combined with just sort of blathering on about the rules and all sorts of stuff. I thought it was a fairly interesting discussion, and I think you'll enjoy it. One problem, I had a little audio mishap of some kind or another, and I got some kind of ground hum going on. Something happened with my compressor. Hardware compressor thing, and I don't know, the jack was sort of jacked up or something, so there was this buzz. I managed to remove most of it with some filters and things like that, but you can occasionally hear it, so gonna have to bear with me on that a little bit of audio quality. That's one thing I like about MotoGPOD, is we do try to keep the audio quality as high as possible, and this one I'm a little bit disappointed. I almost bagged the show, but the conversation is worth listening to, and if I hadn't done this, I would have almost well, I'd have pretty much nothing except me sitting here talking about Motegi by myself. So we got that coming up. And then after that, Jules recorded a little piece talking about an article that he read and Ducati's rise to brilliance and all of that good stuff. And I thought that was good. It's a little short piece, and we're going to play that at the end. We're also going to do a couple of reader emails that came my way that I thought were pretty interesting. But first of all, I'd like to say a big thank you to Graham Reed, J.J. Dewar, or possibly Dewar, I'm not sure how to pronounce that one. Hopefully didn't mess it up too much for you there, JJ. And Emery Baker, all these guys were kind enough to donate to MotoGPOD, help pay for the bandwidth, help pay for the Skype bills, all that sort of thing. I really do appreciate it, guys. Thanks a lot for that. We also had, one thing that Jules and I are talking about, and this came up during the race, when we were watching the race online last weekend, and we were in the chat room at MotoGPOD. There's a chat room, and there was just a whole bunch of people in there. We had kind of a good time watching the race online at MotoGP.com while we were sort of chatting away, with the usual kind of, wow, look at that, sort of a commentary kind of thing. It's fun stuff. And one thing that came up was that when Ant West went in at Motegi, and he did his ride-through penalty, it was suggested, well, why doesn't he, go ahead and change bikes and switch from wet tires to slicks? Because that would have been sort of a good time to do such a thing. And I was thinking, well, it's probably not allowed. Jules looked up the exact ruling, and it's 1.19, ride-through procedure. During the race, the rider will be requested to ride through the pit lane. Stopping is not permitted. He may then rejoin the race. So no changes to the bikes or tires or any kind of thing that's going to happen, because the bike's got to be moving all the time. So that takes care of that one. And just as I suspected, a ride-through is a penalty, and you're not going to be able to combine, a pit stop or something like that with it, because that would just kind of not be fair. And although it's that's how we have to do things. So that was kind of interesting. A couple other mini items that came up in the news. Danny Pedrosa thought he'd broken his foot there in his horrific crash at Motegi. However, it's apparently some kind of arthritis that's aggravated by the crash and all that. So he should be fine. He'll be back for Phillip Island and all that. He's just going to, do some therapy and taking some of the, not muscle relaxers, but anti-inflammatories, things like that. And he should be good to go. And it's also kind of word on the street come to my attention that Colin Edwards' salary next year at Tech 3 Yamaha is going to be being paid by the factory team. He's not be taking a pay cut. He's getting basically the same salary he was getting as a factory rider for riding on the satellite team, which is a pretty good deal. And he's kind of fortunate to get that. And I'm sort of sad to see Colin going down from the factory team down to the satellite team, because it is somewhat of a demotion. However, his results this year have not been all that spectacular. And when you've got Lorenzo coming up, what are you going to do? You're going to have you've got several big names going on here in the sport, Rossi and Lorenzo and all that. You're not going to have Lorenzo riding on the satellite team. If I was in charge of Yamaha, that'd be the same decision I made. But they sweetened the pot for him quite a bit, and apparently he'll be doing all right. So that's good news for Colin, and at least it gives him at least one more year in MotoGP. Okay, that about covers the sort of brief show preview kind of thing we had going on there. Why don't we jump into the rest of the show, start off with some reader email. I got a whole bunch of email last week, almost more than I could keep up with, so I try to reply to every email. If I didn't reply to yours, I do apologize. I had one that bounced, so Hannah, if you didn't get an email back from me, it bounced a couple of times. I even actually sent it from another account, so I don't know if you ever heard back from me, but apparently you've blacklisted my address, so whatever. But let's cover a couple of these emails. I thought some of them were really, really good stuff. And first of all, got an email from Javier Sanchez, longtime listener to MotoGPOD, and he was talking about the survey that's on the MotoGP.com website right now. So this is more of a heads-up email than a real sort of a commentary and all that. He says, it's on the website right now. Should MotoGP adopt a single-tire rule in 2008? And he sent me this on Sunday, and that survey's been up there all week. It's still up there now as I record this, which is late Thursday night, actually early Friday morning for me. And the he says, Javier says, Bob, the votes are split 50-50 at the moment, so if you could get the word out. Not sure what most MotoGPOD fans feel about it, but I'm sure they all have an opinion. And yes, I am indeed sure they have an opinion. And right now, as I record this, the latest numbers are for the should MotoGP adopt a single tire rule in 2008, 12,177 yeses and 13,721 noes. So I figured out the math on that. That's like a 47% yes to no, 47% on the yes side and 53% on the no side. So that's not actually a landslide. I mean, that's you know, relatively close, especially on a survey like this that's sort of the statistical equivalent of, well, you know, kind of nothing. I mean, you can vote as many times as you want, right? But that did come up in the news. I should have mentioned that in my little pre-show intro. I did not. But Carmelo Ezpeleta, the head of Dorna, has suggested that we're going to go to a single tire rule. And you know, if you've been listening to MotoGPOD over the past few weeks, you know that I think that's a terrible idea. And I really hope they don't do that. I almost suspect partially that it might be kind of a semi-threat put out there to get the tire manufacturers to come to some sort of agreement to standardize or to somewhat change the tire rules. I think they've decided that the tire rules as they are now are a bit of a mistake and they need some tweaking and tuning. My suggestion is have the manufacturers bring as many tires as they want on, you know, Thursday, but that the riders don't have to make that selection. But basically, you're prohibiting the Michelin bringing in new tires Saturday night. So the tire manufacturers just bring in, they want to bring in 12 truckload of tires, let them bring in that many tires, however many they want, or maybe they could even limit the number that the tire manufacturers bring in, you know, so many, I don't know, probably thousands, but that wouldn't really make sense because you can have different numbers of teams using Michelin versus Bridgestone versus Dunlop, but whatever. They'd be bringing in a lot of tires. The riders go ahead and make their selections like they used to do in 2006 and previous, where you just here, have some tires, do whatever you want. Or even if they need to limit the tires, that's fine. But don't make the riders make all those selections on Thursday. That's a huge mistake. It doesn't work. It's not a good rule. This is not Formula One, and we don't want it to turn into Formula One where they have this mishmash of the two tires and you have to use one of each and all that kind of crap. I think that what we need to go back to is something where the riders have a little more flexibility on the tires, but I do also, on the flip side, understand Bridgestone's sort of position that Michelin's practice of basically custom making tires to ship in on Saturday night was somewhat of an imbalance and led things away from Bridgestone, even though Bridgestone could have done the same thing for Motegi and even Phillip Island, Malaysia, all the Asian races. I don't see why they couldn't have gotten the tires there that quickly too. And that's not quite half and half, but it would at least tip the scale somewhat back to Bridgestone sides. But whatever, we're going to take that out of the mix, bring the tires in. That's my suggestion. So I encourage you, go to the MotoGP.com site. That survey's been up a lot longer than most of their surveys are. I don't know how much longer it will be there, but it is there right now as of early Friday morning Pacific time. So if you have not yet voted, go ahead and go up there and vote. Vote whatever you think. If you think they should have a single tire rule, vote yes. If you think they should have a no single tire rule, which is what I think, then vote no. Okay, the next email is actually kind of a combination of several emails. I heard from quite a few Australian listeners about the piece that the Australian version, the Australian show of 60 Minutes, they did a piece on Casey Stoner being the new world champion. And I heard this from Australian listeners, and I was actually lucky enough to be able to see the episode, the segment of that. And, you know, it's basically sort of I would call it a fluff piece talking about, you know, new Casey Stoner is the now champion and all that good stuff. What I thought was significant and actually very sad was that the announcer said, you know, that Casey Stoner's been battling with Valentino Rossi and that Valentino Rossi was last year's world champion. And it's just like, geez, what does Hayden have to do to get any cred? So I was a little disappointed in that. But other than that, it was a real interesting piece. Unfortunately, I can't post it. And I'm not going to put a lot of the audio in here. But what I think you should do is go to YouTube and check it out. I'm sure it's on there somewhere from on YouTube. The Australian version of 60 Minutes doing a Casey Stoner bit. That was kind of a fun thing to watch. And then our last email that we're going to read here is dealing with the tire rule. We're back to tires again. Hey. And this is from Aaron Jones. You know, maybe if I'd been doing this podcast with any sort of thought and preparation ahead of time, I would have combined the tire rules so they were next to each other instead of diverging, but whatever. So we're back to Aaron Jones's email. Sorry, Aaron. Aaron said, and this I thought was an excellent reason, email. He says, I read about all the controversies surrounding the tire rules. Something extremely interesting is happening behind the scenes. I'm wondering how much of the rider influence, meaning Valentino and Pedrosa, how much influence they've had in the shape of the way things are coming out. I say this as Pedrosa has been linked heavily to pushing HRC to switch to Bridgestones, and Valentino has also come out basically intimating the same. So what gives? Most of the comments on a lot of the BBS and forums say the same thing, that Michelin dominates for years and no one complains, and then all of a sudden Bridgestone finally becomes competitive and now it's time for a single tire. Which I agree with that, John, you know, Aaron. It's a bit like, you know, gosh, Michelin has one bad year and all of a sudden everybody wants a single tire rule. It makes me question the true intentions of the sport. And he puts that in quotes, the sport. Are we cultivating a sport or is it Dorna and the FIM cultivating a spectacle that they can sell to the masses? If this is the case, then only the most marketable faces will be advantaged to win the championship, not the most talented rider or the best manufacturer and tire and rider combination. Let's bow out to marketing and make sure that Rossi, Pedrosa, and whichever rider represented the biggest marketing advantage for MotoGP. And he says that's rubbish. And I have to agree with you, Aaron. It is rubbish. Unfortunately, that is somewhat the way it is. Let's go ahead and continue with Aaron's email real quick. I understand that the racing has not been very close this season at times, but we have had some of the most amazing races. Qatar, Catalunya, Rossi-Stoner duels at Jerez, Mugello with Pedrosa and Rossi duels. Surprise podiums like Barros, Hopkins, Vermeulen. Wet weather races. This has been a heck of a year. If anything, things have gotten more interesting, not boring. Each race you have to wonder what will determine the race outcome. Will it be tires, horsepower, rain or heat, or rider error, or the occasional torpedoing someone off the track? And don't forget, Guintoli also torpedoing someone off the track there, Aaron. So I thought that was a good email from Aaron. I really appreciated that one. I thought he well put, and it sums up nicely what I think is the same situation, that yes, Michelin has been totally dominant, and I don't think it's Michelin saying, you know, we're going to bail. It seems to be more almost the riders are saying, but some of this has become somewhat of a moot point. Yamaha, they're going to be on Michelin's. Previo said so. This is a done deal. The Pedrosa HRC is also, they're going to be on Michelin, so they're not abandoning unless they go with this single tire rule. If they go with a single tire rule, then obviously everything's out the door, right? Out the window. But I truly do suspect, going back to the whole survey and the Carmela Espelita suggesting a single tire rule and all of that sort of thing, I think that it's just some kind of ploy and that that won't actually happen. I certainly hope that's the case. So again, encourage you, go to MotoGP.com. If that survey is still there, go ahead and cast your vote. Let's see if we can get every MotoGP OD listener to vote no. But like I said before, if you think that it should be yes, that they should, yes, have a tire rule, then you go ahead and vote yes. But whatever. We will have some good racing next season no matter what. It's just, will it be the best possible racing or will it be something that's somewhat determined by, you know, the single tire and all of that sort of thing? We'll just have to wait and find out, I guess, won't we? Okay, we got Jules Cheesick on the phone. How you doing, Jules?
I'm doing great, Bob.
Good, good. So, Motegi, let's just jump right into it. I know you're a busy guy. You don't have a whole lot of time tonight, and I've got stuff been a busy week, actually. But let's talk a little bit about Motegi. I mean, we were watching it. It was in an unusual time, Saturday night, 10 o'clock for us on the Pacific Coast. And we were watching it. And if I recall correctly, you kind of left the chat room somewhat in disgust.
I didn't want to ruin anybody else's perception. The people were, you know, discussing the race. I was trying to discuss my point of view. My point of view, which was just an opinion, got taken as an affront, and I didn't want to, you know, upset anybody. So I thought it'd be better just to take off. And you know, before that, it was great being in there and being able to talk to everybody, considering how crazy the race was, and just going, my God, I can't believe it.
The thing is when I saw the whole, the race and I managed to sort of follow some of the free practice, I didn't kind of catch any of the qualifying news until, you know, race, the morning of the race during the, you know, like 15 minutes prior to the race.
Right.
And the weather had been perfect and stuff. And then it's like, it's raining on race day. And it's like, oh my God. So right off the bat, I was a little bit, shall we say, disappointed.
Totally. You know, worried. Considering that we know what has happened during previous rain races this year, I mean, it was like, especially this kind of a rainy race where it's not like all out rain, it was like, okay, so all this great build up to this, you know, incredibly classic battle is just basically been tossed in the garbage. And, you know, we know it, we'll see a good race, but it could be a complete dice toss.
Yeah, exactly. And it's you have to kind of think of the rain races as a standalone. They don't have a lot of bearing on the whole championship, other than obviously, you know, they do because of the points. But I mean, as far as what you're actually watching on track, it's not what you're sort of seeing as a microcosm of the championship as a whole.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I enjoyed the race. I unfortunately had everything was going wrong that could possibly go wrong. I had internet issues. I had to go down to the smallest little crunchy vision kind of MotoGP.
I think everybody had that problem because it kept going out. I mean, we just ended up switching to, and we were watching the race in my son's room because he has the biggest screen, a computer with the biggest screen in the house, and he's a big fan, and this was like one of the races where he didn't have to get up really early to watch it with us, so he was really psyched to watch it.
Yeah.
And we ended up having to switch to the 200 kilobit per second feed and just put a full screen and watch the big pixels moving around, you know?
Yeah. I just, when I do that, I was doing the little 200 kilobit feed too, and, you know, I mean, the screen is, I think it's like 120 pixels wide or something crazy small.
Yeah.
I just leave it that small because you blow it up super huge and you just had, like you say, it's like watching an Atari 800 video game.
Well, we have to do that because he's like up on a bunk bed. Anyway, so.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, yeah, we digress. The race itself, like I said, it was all the free practice, all that stuff. I mean, Pedrosa dominated all the practice sessions.
It was just shaping up to be a great, great weekend race. I think everybody wanted to see a showdown between Stoner, Rossi, Pedrosa.
Sure.
And Stoner was looking pretty bad though, during all of the pre-race stuff. I mean, he was down in eighth in qualifying. He was down in practice. And it was Pedrosa that was really looking. It looked like maybe a repeat of Estrel, which would be a very big surprise considering Ducati's history at Motegi in the last few years.
Right, yes. But Stoner apparently had some kind of difficulties in qualifying, which might be possibly explain his poor qualifying performance. They had to change forks or something, so he missed like half the qualifying session.
Yep.
Somebody was saying that, yeah. And it did. It shaped up to be a good race, and then it rained. And that's rain is the big equalizer, but with the new rules, and this was the first big test of the new rules in a big, big way, where you have the guys going out on wets, but then the track is drying, so they're coming back on slicks. And this is the first time that the entire field pretty much came back in on and got on slicks. We've had riders, you know, a few, like where they come in and they get slicks and they sort of take a chance and stuff like that.
Well, no, we had that at Le Mans, too.
With the whole field?
I don't remember if... I mean, some people crashed out on slicks. Oh no! Yeah. I mean, in Le Mans it was the same situation, wasn't it? We started with the rain, and then it started to dry up, and the tires started to get eaten up. Or was it up?
Yeah, but I don't.
Okay.
Maybe I'm just not recalling it. I don't recall everybody coming in and pitting and everything like that. I mean, quite so much where this race, what boiled down to was is almost like watching a Formula One race or something where you had pit strategy.
It was pit strategy, exactly.
Yeah. But nobody had any clue of what the hell strategy they should play other than, you know, they had their pit board telling them maybe and you know, just sort of a hunch or whatever. But it's not like something like in Formula One where it's figured out ahead of time.
Well, there was some incredibly amazing, actually, pit entries, I should say.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, you're right. In general, it was kind of a mayhem. And this is like...
Yeah.
I have not formulated exactly how I feel about... Like, in my head, like I just know I didn't like what I saw because I think that there's just too much danger in the way that these these bike swaps happen. You know, we've only had this like four times now where we had bike swaps. And I know they practiced.
Yeah, it's only been a few times. Yeah.
But like, yeah. there was a moment where like I think it was Vermeulen who was coming out. I mean, he did a stoppie, you know, because he was about to slam into some guy. So you know, it's a very strange rule, and I don't like rules that are made just for the sake of TV schedules, which this is the case, right?
Yeah, and on that one, you said that, and I was sort of a little bit kind of like, you know, how so-ish. And why don't you explain it? Why is that made for TV rule?
Because I think that restarting races like they used to, when conditions changed drastically, meant that the races would run over their allotted time, and every network would have to scramble to reshuffle their shows and whatever. This is clearly Dorna's way of making sure that the spectacle is confined into the same amount of time that they allot every time. You know, that's what it seems right to me. I mean, like, and there was the confusion, of course, of like, well, how do you count the points? Do you like take a little bit of from the first race? In 2004, they had a rule where, or 2005 actually also, right? They had the rule where you. You completely blew away the results from the previous race, and then had a little six lap sprint, right? And then before that, like you aggregated times, which nobody could keep track of. But you know what? There is no perfect rule for wet racing. I think that the best thing to do would be to have the race direction declare a race dangerous, and by that I mean. The conditions change drastically, where the tires are no longer valid for the condition of the track, and do a restart only in those conditions. So, in other words, still have rain races, fine. Still have obviously dry races, but when the conditions on the track change drastically, you know. And we've had a discussion about this on Right On Two, and I understand that logistically it would be extremely hard to do, and audiences would be kind of screwed. Like, you know, the whole restarting the race, like, how many laps do you do? Like, okay, what if they did, you know, 20 laps? Does that mean you just finish off the race? Do you do the entire race over? You know, I understand that there's no perfect solution. I just feel like the pitting rule is just making... making the race a complete dice toss.
Yeah,
you know,
and I think that's a fair assumption. One thing that we saw one difference with Le Mans, not Milan, was that I think it was the opposite. They started on slicks and had to go to wet.
I think you're right.
Yeah, which I mean,
but then it started to dry out again, and that's why like, the wet started to get
So and that was a big mess.
The thing is, you can't cancel a race. Like AMA actually will not race in the wet, right?
Well, they sometimes race unless it's really wet, that kind of a thing.
Right.
And so you know, you see them racing in the rain, but they are quick to cancel it if it's quite you know wet because so many of the tracks they race at are crap.
And the thing is, you're not kicking out a crowd of 150,000 people either. You know, like
exactly.
AMA races,
and I mean,
don't have that kind of fan base.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and but what about, I mean, if we want to talk about race series that, you know, because I've said this, I got a lot of email about the wet tire rules and all sorts of different things. And one comment that I tended to reuse in my emails was, you know, what kind of racing series would cancel the races just because it rains? And the obvious answer and what I was getting at was NASCAR. I mean, they only bring rain tires to their two road course races a year. And I understood, I read somewhere something that these rain tires are so old, they're not even sure they're any good.
So oh, my God.
I thought that was funny. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I don't want to get on a big, giant NASCAR is crap bashing session, but, you know, I'm always ready for it. But, you know, we're digressing.
You know, World Superbike will cancel races when the conditions get too bad. I don't see why MotoGP... I mean, I do see why MotoGP wouldn't want to, but... I don't know. There's no perfect solution. Basically, I'm fine with the rules staying as it is. Just maybe they should like half the points that come out of it. Or, I don't know. Do something that where it doesn't totally throw the championship battle into the pot. You know, and I don't know. I don't want to dwell on it too much.
Yeah.
Let's just get into the actual race because it was definitely exciting.
Yes, it was. There was a lot of stuff going on.
We finally got to see what the battles look like in the ninth position because they were up front.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we've kind of talked a lot about the race before we actually started talking about the race here. But basically, let's run down the grid real
sure.
quick. I mean, just we're racing through it. Faster than Nick Harris and Kevin Eklund ever do it. Front row, Danny Pedrosa, Valentino Rossi, and Nicky Hayden. Cool front row. Looking forward to, yeah, some good stuff. And kind of a change up, you know, let's see a repeat of Estoril where it's not a stoner runaway and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Second row, Randy Dupuynier, Tony Elias, and Anthony West. So the Kawasaki's getting on the second row because all the qualifying sessions and everything was dry. So that was kind of cool.
Yep.
Third row, Colin Edwards, Loris Caparossi, and Casey Stoner. Like I said, Coast Stoner had a terrible qualifying session because of... They apparently changed the forks on the bikes and all sorts of stuff. He basically missed half the qualifying session. And he also hit a false neutral or something. Was that during qualifying or warm-up?
I thought that was at Estoril, wasn't it?
No, yeah, but I mean, then it happened again.
Oh, it happened again? I did not know that.
Yeah,
no. I do know that he had that little altercation with Cheka. I don't know what that was about.
Yeah, I didn't even see the news on that one. Yeah, that was bizarre.
They were just yelling at each other, and like, basically, this was the first weekend where it looked like Stoner was cracking under pressure. He was unhappy about stuff, and he was really letting it know. Like, he was storming around. He looked upset. He totally lashed out at Cheka. It was very strange. I was talking to a friend of mine about it, and we couldn't figure out exactly what happened between them. But Cheka made a statement afterwards, and he just basically said, like, you know, we had a little something, and I'm not going to go into it, but Casey should calm down and just concentrate on the championship, which I thought was good advice from the senior to the junior.
Yeah, yeah. Know? The very, very senior. That's actually, I hadn't even read that story or saw the incident or anything like that. And that's super kind of interesting that Stoner would feel that way on this weekend. Because, I mean, come on, the guy's got the championship all but in the bag. You know, it wasn't a mathematical certainty, but it was, for all intents and purposes, it was his. So maybe it was just because this is the weekend where it's going to be a mathematical certainty and all of that.
It was also mathematical certainty last week as well. If it had been, if he had won and Rossi had finished, what was it, 11th? I think you said. But
yeah.
But the thing is that I think that he was. I mean, he certainly was struggling. So he was struggling, and he has this championship thing, and like he wants to win races. He's not just there to win the championship. He wants to win races. And he was just struggling on the bike all weekend. I think he just doesn't know the track that well, to tell you the truth.
That's a possibility, too.
You know?
Yeah. But, so, anyways, continuing on down the grid, let's see, fourth row, Marco Melandri, John Hopkins, Shinya Nakano. John Hopkins didn't have a very good qualifying session. Actually, the Suzuki's kind of pretty much sucked at the Motegi this year. Fifth row, massive in the pronunciation, Kosuke Akiyoshi, wild card rider for Suzuki. You know, he's got track knowledge going on and all sorts of different advantages here for why he can, you know, do better than their factory rider Vermeulen and stuff like that. Carlos Checa and Alex Barros rounding out the fifth row. Prime McDantine did not have a good weekend. Unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to talk to Liam. I haven't heard from him much. Have you talked to Liam lately?
He's very sick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. I guess maybe the weather and all the traveling. What he said is it's just all the flying with sick people is what finally did him in.
Oh, yeah.
So he's
every time. It's like a big germ factory. Yeah.
Exactly. So he's in recovery mode right now.
Okay. And sixth row, Makoto Tomata, Chris Vermeulen, just a terrible qualifying performance, and Sylvain Guattoli. And then on the seventh row, which we're rounding out a full 21 riders on the grid this race, Akira Yanagawa, the wild card rider for Kawasaki, Shinichi Ito, who is the replacement rider on Premek Dantin for the fired Alex Hoffman, like we talked about last week, and Curtis Roberts in his unfortunately very, very sad customary position on the grid.
Yep. I was really excited, by the way, about Yanagawa being running on the Kawis because, I don't know, I've always had a little soft spot for the guy. He was a great World Superbike rider. He's been around for a while. He's done a lot of the 24-hour races, and he's a good all-around rider.
Yeah, and it's cool. I like Motegi for that because the Japanese factories tend to bring in these wild card riders. And it is kind of cool. Yeah. So on to the race. It had already been raining by the time, you know, that morning. The warm up was in the wet and everything. It was declared a wet race.
We had two
right
wet races before that as well.
Yeah. The 125s and 250s were both wet races. Exactly. So it was, you know, the whole thing was again, especially after the Friday and Saturday. Friday was beautiful, and I guess Saturday was a pretty good day, and then all of a sudden it starts raining. And it just threw everything, you know, like you said, everything goes out the window. This becomes this sort of standalone weird race.
It wasn't just the wetness. It was also the temperature, because it was incredibly hot and humid the day before. I know Jim Race posted some photos on Ride On 2, and there was like this photo of Hopper like clutching this fan to him because it was just so damn hot. And so I think basically all the data that they collected was kind of useless on race day. And that part of it I actually like. I like to see teams being able to adjust to changing conditions. So, you know, I'm not... When I was really ranting about the whole rain racing thing, I you know, obviously this isn't part of it. It's just what we do when people go into pits and stuff like that, and when they go into pits. So,
yeah.
All right.
Stoner got this. It was just unbelievable start.
Had a bad start yet this year?
Probably not.
I really don't think so. Actually, has he ever had a bad start in MotoGP? Because that was his big strength last year as well. He may have not finished the races all the time, but he always has had this incredible ability to just fire off from the start. And so it's not like it's because he's in a Ducati or anything like that. It's because he just has incredible reflexes.
Right. Super great reflexes and everything else. Yeah, I mean, he could well be the next, you know, Valentino Rossi.
Yep.
We could be seeing him in the making. We'll just sort of have to see. And the comparison actually is more like with Michael Schumacher, where he takes a team that, you know, has all kinds of visions of former glory, but really haven't been doing a whole lot lately, sort of a thing. And the next thing you know, they're, you know, dominating everybody else in a just, you know, complete way. I'm trying to check here real quick of his qualifying positions. I think this is his worst qualifying position of the year, is it not?
Ninth, right? You know,
yeah, I don't recall him.
I don't recall him being any lower than ninth.
I think eighth was his lowest before. Yeah. So he's been on the third row this season, but he hasn't been, you know, he didn't have a good start to the weekend. And what with the weather and all, who knows? But
he made up
for it. Yeah, he made up for it on that start because it was just impressive. He was up to what, fourth?
He was second, I think, wasn't he?
Nick Harris was so confused on the commentary. I was watching the race again. Casey Stoner leads the way. It's like, no, dude, he's in third.
And I was watching, watching the pixelated version. So,
yeah. Basically, the watching the pixelated version forces you to pay more attention to the commentary.
Yeah, unfortunately, and, you can't see the numbers.
Yeah, he was. He did. There was two missteps right in a row about Casey Stoner. And it's like Nick Harris has a new sort of, Ant West is not not performing, so Casey Stoner's going to be Nick Harris's new Superman.
Well, in this case, West was performing, sort of, because he was up front.
He was. Well, Ant West was, yes, exactly. And Ant West got a false start, which Gavin Emmett saw, and some of the guys that were in the MotoGPOD and Ride On 2 chat room where we were. There's a whole bunch of us in there.
Yeah.
And they said, Anthony West is a false start, which they may have seen already on Eurosport because there's a delay. But whatever it was, people caught that, and it was a bad false start. And basically, the lights lasted a little longer than usual. It's a random time, because you don't want to have some sort of rhythm going on of like, the lights go red, 1, 2, 3, now we start,
right.
It's gotta be it's a random thing. And Ant West was unfortunately caught out, and you could see he knew he was caught out right from the beginning. He like went, Oh shit. And then it's like, well, let's start and, maybe they won't notice, but on the other hand, what's he supposed to do? You wait till you get the pit thing, this, ride through penalty, and then you do your ride through penalty. So that was unfortunate for Ant West because he was on a charge. He was doing well. How much of that was due to the false start? I don't know. I kind of doubt really that any of it was due to the false start much, because he really had lost the false start momentum by the time the lights actually went out.
Because he hesitated afterwards.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was almost like a disadvantage, other than the guys like, 8 inches farther ahead than the other guy.
Yeah.
And so it's not like it was a big advantage for him or anything like that. But no, he got right off the bat again, showing he's a wet weather. He's like Gibernau always used to be, where when it rains and stuff, you might be able to count on Ant West. He got a great start. He was right out there out front. He was running a good race, and then he finally got it was a ways down the order before he finally got the pit board order to come in and do his ride through penalty. And we had a little mini sort of not an argument, but a kind of a thing of discussion of like he should have changed tires during that. And I meant to check the rules, and I didn't.
Oh yeah,
that I don't think they can. I think
somebody mentioned actually that they did check the rules, and they it's true, they cannot. It is actually a penalty. Therefore, you're not allowed to do anything to the bike when you do the drive through.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised. That's sort of fairly normal for that sort of a thing.
Yep.
As a whole, when you print out the race classification from MotoGP, they always put the little writer notes about so and so crashed out or so and so retired or whatever, and it's normally 5 lines. It's taken up 2 pages. So yeah. That's kind of flipping. That's kind of flipping.
Well, it's got all the joined, rejoined.
Exactly. So and so entered pits and this and that. Right. And Curtis Roberts went into the pits before Anthony West got his ride through penalty. So he was doing that same strategy that he had done before, where it's kind of like, well, things aren't working right now. Let's see if I throw on some slicks, if I can get, at least catch up to these guys.
Right.
And, but it's kind of the race as a whole devolved into this. I mean, Rossi got a terrible start. Hayden got a pretty good start, but faded fast.
Yep.
And it was a Pedrosa, Stoner, mishmash, Ant West. Yeah, and I mean, there were so many lead changes per lap. The official lap chart shows you who finished the lap in the lead, but it doesn't say anything about how many lead changes there may have been on that lap. And it was almost confusing to follow. You really had sort of no idea of what was going to happen. And then once we knew Ant West had a false start or a jump start, the commentators are going, well, Ant West isn't first on the track, but really, at this point, Stoner's first in the race and this kind of business.
Right.
And it was just
he's doing what he's got to do. and all that kind of stuff. So it was good. It was the thing is that, you know, it was the kind of race that we kind of hoped for. Stoner overcame his bad qualifying position and got into the lead. If you take West out, and then we had, you know, Danny and Melandri had a great start too.
Melandri had an awesome first few laps.
Really, yeah. So he was great.
He was on fire.
And then Rossi started doing his reining them in. It was amazing how much faster he was catching up to those guys.
Right.
Making up for his poor start, which is actually also like a trademark of his nowadays. It's almost like he's, I don't know, he's never been a good starter, but not this bad.
Right. He does seem to be a bit of a, almost, it's a little mysterious about how, maybe there's something going on with the clutch or who knows what, but he's not getting very good starts, and it's a little weird.
I could say maybe he's just getting older. I mean, reflexes are all there at the start. That's one place where you really need to have that light goes off, you know, clutch goes out, and off you go.
Right. Now that's a possibility too. And he's the interesting thing I thought to a point was Rossi's never been what I called a classic sort of wet racer. You know what I mean?
Nope.
It's not like he all of a sudden got this big advantage because it's raining. Yet in this particular race, he did very well of his, you know, moving up, size up the opponent for a little bit, make the pass, and you know, continued on that. And so he progressed up the order within the first five laps. He was in third spot, you know, and considering he was in seventh on lap one, you know, he's trucking right along.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's see. Where this whole thing is a little bit of a mishmash of a race report, because the race was a little bit of a mishmash. So we're kind of jumping around. Yeah, it really was. I mean, at points you sort of you knew that okay, so and so like the announcer was saying, Ant West is first on track, but he's got a ride through penalty. But then at a deeper level, you sort of knew, well, okay, this guy is out front. Well, Rossi, for instance, was out front, but he had not yet pitted. And at one point, he was I think there was something like 7 or 8 laps left in the race, and he was losing, I don't know, it was like 3 or 4 seconds a lap.
Yeah, I was about halfway through the race, I would say.
Right. And he hadn't pitted, but you're almost thinking, well, you know, he's in first, and I actually sort of thought it before I kind of did the math that, you know, he might just
try
might just finish, and on the wet.
There was an amazing moment, I think, that like where so you know Melandri was leading from I believe like the fourth lap or fifth lap,
right.
He overtook Stoner, and they had a little bit of a nice little fight there, and then Rossi caught Stoner and passed him, and then he caught Melandri, and the moment that he passed him, that's when Melandri said, "Okay, I'm going into the pits." That was really, and it was just crazy because they were both coming out of that tunnel, you know,
right?
And they were both going full speed, and all of a sudden, Melandri just goes straight, If anything else, that was worth seeing the pitting. It's like how quickly he made up his mind. He was like, I think he's probably planning for that during the lap. He's like, if Rossi passes me, I'm going in.
Yeah, right. And it was almost scary. You almost thought something was wrong
or something
was happening. Yeah, exactly. And that's another thing that we saw on this race was that pit entrance to Motegi. Did they have a few more 90-degree turns in there?
That's true.
Jeez. Yeah. You know, it's like a driveway. And, you know, so you know, that was a little painful. But, yeah, like you said, Rossi had the lead briefly. And then Caparossi, when did Caparossi pit?
I think he pit lap 6 or 7 or something like that.
Yeah.
Pretty early on.
And
maybe 10? Lap 10.
Yeah, it was 14 minutes, 19 seconds into the race, and he pitted. Or he entered pits and came back out. And, I think that the race boiled down to the, again, like I said, pit strategy.
Yep.
Of when do you pit? And because the race, the track wasn't quite dry enough at the very, very early stages. You know, Curtis pitted too early. But some of the other guys, it might have left it too late, including Rossi. There was a lot of talk of, you know, when the hell's he going to pit? When's he going to pit? When's he going to pit?
I think he was basically, you know, just like at Estoril. I think he was maybe hoping that the rain would start again or something. I don't know. I mean, he was doing well, but he doesn't know that Guintoli was running like laps like 5 seconds faster than his. This right. board didn't tell him that. They just told him, okay, box, go in, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so Guintoli got to pass Valentino Rossi, I think it's the second time this year.
Yeah.
And so, he's going to put that in his scrapbook. But what screwed Rossi for the race as a whole was that he repitted. Because he went into the pits, he got on cut slicks, which if you're not familiar with the cut slick, it's a regular slick tire where somebody, actually a person, has gone through with a knife and cut. Sipes into this tire, and they do it as a different pattern. It's probably one of those things like all these other sort of hand done things where different guys have their different methods, and they know that, oh well, if it's this wet, I'll do this kind of pattern and whatever. So he did that, and he went out on these cut slicks, and he just right off the bat seemed to be having troubles.
Yeah.
And basically, it seemed like the front was going to tuck, and so he went back in, and they took a look at the bike and sent it back out.
And afterwards, he said that the reason was because the tire felt like it was flat.
Yeah.
And
right.
Colin Edwards and Nicky Hayden also said the same thing.
Yeah. And now that could possibly be. I mean, there's so many reasons why that feeling would come through. That a lack of familiarity with the cut slick, say especially on the 800cc bikes. Motegi, all kinds of different things. But whatever it was, it affected several of these guys. And it boiled down to that this whole race was a tire choice, pit strategy, this and that kind of gamble. And this showed, because after lap 15, Loris Caparossi led every lap. And actually, it stabilized lap 16, where you had Loris Caparossi, Randy Dupuynier, and... Tony Elias, 1-2-3.
And Randy Dupuynier, who ran off the track twice.
Twice. He went into the gravel a couple of times, and still, I mean, he had a good ride. You got to give the guy credit. You know, he did really well. Who knows? With the weather and stuff like that, and it's his first, it's his highest finish. I believe it was his first podium, was it not, in the MotoGP? And, he got a second, he's got the big trophy to put in the trophy case and all that stuff, and I'm happy for him, I think it's cool.
Yeah.
But the results from Motegi don't apply to the season as a whole. It was very close that we almost had two French guys on the podium, because Sylvain Guintoli was right up there. And then the last few laps, we were sort of thinking that Guintoli, who ended up finishing fourth, might be able to pass Elias, and he actually had it done at one point. And sort of, botched it, ran wide, whatever, and Elias got past him again.
And also, Elias did turn up the heat, because Elias ended up with the fastest lap of the race.
Yeah. Did he have the fastest,
yep.
fastest lap? Okay, cool.
Yep.
Again, one more time, the race was a mishmash. The finish was a mishmash. Here, you've got your podium. You got Loris Caparossi, who does, he's the kind of guy you expect to see on the podium now and then, but not so much this year. And then Randy Dupuynier and Tony Elias. So, it's cool that Randy Dupuynier got his first podium. He's, like I said, he'll have a, nifty trophy and all that kind of stuff. And it's, he did win a race. Whether you think that it's, total crap or anything like that. Hey, or not win, but excuse me, take second. And so his best finish of his career so far, that's kind of good for him, seeing as, he's going to be out of Kawasaki and all that. But let's see, Tony Elias, I'm looking at Elias, because Elias is fighting off, injuries and all of that stuff. So this is his best finish since Turkey, where he finished second.
Yep. Both these guys, actually, if you think about it, they had good position. So they were fast all weekend. So it's not, they're not undeserving. It's just that knowing that the if you look at the actual analysis of their free practice, it's really only during the qualifying where they really stepped up. So, like, you know, Tony probably is still a little bit weak, and Randy's always good in qualifying and then not so good during the races. So
tends to fade, yeah.
You know, and then, you know, Loris winning the race, like they call him the Wizard of Motegi. Great. I mean, I'm very happy for the guy, and I've always loved Loris, his style of racing and whatever. But you know, to give him credit for this one, I think is a little bit, is pushing a little bit. I mean,
a bit much. You think, really?
I mean, He won by 10 seconds. He won by, smart strategy, but it was pit strategy that won the race. I don't want to say anything that negative about it. He won the race. That's what matters in the end. And he does have a good history here, so it's kind of cool that he did.
The thing is, we're a bit spoiled in MotoGP because, I mean, this is true racing. You know, it's a sprint for, 45-odd minutes or so of, who the hell finished fastest. It's not any of the usual crap of NASCAR, Formula One, or whatever, with the pitting and all of that business. You just race and you finish. And I mean, to me, that's pure racing. That's the way it should be. I enjoy Formula One with the pit stops, and I think that Formula One without pit stops is total rubbish because there's no overtaking. But in motorcycle racing, there's overtaking, you have a chance to even if you may not have qualified on pole or you got a bad start or all those sorts of other things, you still have a chance to win the race if you're the fastest guy out there, which is not always true of car series because, there's just not enough track. But, I digress. So, yes, you're right. Not to cheapen their podium positions and everything, but they are a little bit unusual. And Sylvain Guettoli also taking, I believe, his highest finish of the season.
Oh, yeah.
He, by far, finished in fourth, so he gets something he can put in his scrapbook. And we like Sylvain Guettoli because he talked to us at Laguna Seca. So.
He just seems like a nice guy.
He did actually seem like a very, very nice guy. And
he's also going to be on riding with Pramac, Dan Teen. So, it's going to be great to see
him. Who knows? Maybe we'll get a chance to talk to him again on the phone call, since we got kind of the semi hookup going on with Pramac, maybe.
Yep.
Fifth position, Marco Melandri. After having ridden out, an interesting race. He led the race for a lot, almost not quite half, like a third, yeah. And a variety of factors sort of came in, and the next thing you know, the guy finished fifth. But considering the injuries and all of that sort of thing that he's had, it's still an admirable effort. We didn't actually cover retirements, but we'll get to those here in a second.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I forgot to mention that.
Because there's a couple of spectacular ones. Number six, Casey Stoner. So, and this was another topic of discussion all over the place, was, boy, what a way to win the championship by finishing sixth.
Yep.
And the thing is, it's his worst position of the year as far as finishing.
Yep.
But he finished. And the thing is, you can't pick and choose exactly how that mathematical certainty of the championship is going to end up, unless you're going to be like, some sort of weird thing that he had going of tanking it to try to finish at Phillip Island, which I almost sort of thought after Estoril, but there's too many unknowns in this race.
I'll tell you something. Stoner even said it himself. He likes to run races up front.
Yeah.
He doesn't like the dicing. He actually claims that nobody likes the dicing, that Valentino Rossi is full of it when he says he likes to dice with people. It's a good race because they're dicing. And so I'm sure he takes the same exact attitude towards the championship. I don't think he'd be toying with it at all. I think he's a very serious guy, and he just wants to make sure he wins.
Yeah. I agree. I think he's the consummate professional.
Yeah.
There was a sixth... Australian version of 60 Minutes, which I'll have to send you the video, Jules. But they had a feature on Casey Stoner having won the title, and they said that he was battling with the last year's world champion, Valentino Rossi. And I'm like,
oh my God, are you serious?
Hayden gets no credit whatsoever.
Poor guy.
It's like, just screw that guy. It doesn't matter.
Wow. But, that's
wild. Yeah, I thought that was harsh. And that brings
well, I'm
up
glad
something.
We're not the only ignorant ones here in America.
Yeah. Every now and then, you know, what the hell? But Cycle News magazine, Michael Scott, has an article in there. And I want to bring this up real quick while we're talking about Stoner. Yeah, it was just a great article. This is the best part of Cycle News, I think, is the back page where it's sort of an opinion piece. And this particular one is starts off with, you know, do you like conspiracy theories? Here's one that Honda deliberately built a dud bike for 2007. And then Michael Scott goes on in great detail about why this conspiracy theory exists. You know, he doesn't necessarily subscribe to it, and he says later on. But basically that the conspiracy is that Honda did it on purpose to avoid taking the blame for all the changes to the rules that have happened over the last thing. Because, you know, it's clearly that they do drive a lot of the rule changes Honda does. And, you know, that I don't think is a conspiracy theory. I think that's a freaking fact. But,
right.
You know, but, when you're the big guy in the block, you're the 800-pound gorilla, right?
Yeah, and the thing is that, like, you know, the whole thing about let's just cut one cylinder out of the motor and that'll be our 800. It was, you know.
Right.
There was a lot of right. a lot of funny commentary about that last year.
Right, right. But, you know, Michael Scott goes on to think that, no, he says that Honda basically, they blew it on their own and just got off to a misstart. Maybe they were complacent or what have you and this and that and the other. And his point is that there's not a lot of conspiracy theories going on, that the problem with this season, at least the last, you know, well, Bruno and Laguna Seca and whatever the race was after Bruno Misano, that, you know, the processional parade of, you know, wow, you know, there's Casey Stoner, you know, 30 seconds ahead of everybody else. He says that the problem is not that there's some kind of giant conspiracy or anything like that. He says the problem is that Stoner is simply that much better than everybody else. Yeah. And that because of the marriage of the bike, and this is what we've said before, right bike, right tire, right guy, right time, et cetera, it all kind of converges to make the perfect storm for Casey Stoner. Obviously not for Loris Capirossi. I mean, the guy is you know, way down there in the championship. So it's not like, oh, the Ducati's the best thing in the paddock and anybody can ride it. It's just that somehow, some way, everything lined up for Stoner, and he is very, very good. And everybody else is just trying to play catch-up. So, you know, next year, things are going to be different. Maybe. But continuing on down the classification, we'll make some comments as we go along. Anthony West, a great performance after he, you know, had his ride-through and all of that sort of thing. I thought, actually, maybe he didn't do too bad.
Well, he had two drive-throughs, if you think about it.
Yeah, exactly, because he had to pit as well, yeah. Right?
Yep.
And so, yeah, and yeah, it was a good performance. Alex Barros finishing in eighth, which after such a miserable qualifying is also not too bad. Because he qualified down there, you know, I mean, he picked up seven spots. So
yeah, but probably was in the pits. Sorry.
Yeah, I know, but, you know.
That's the thing, is like especially since we didn't see that race. We didn't see much of Capirossi either until after he was leading, right? So we don't really see that much racing.
Right.
We just kind of heard what was going on, and there was so much confusion. The cameras didn't know where to point to. I mean, I'm sure the directors in the Dorna were probably like, you know, what do we point at now? What are we going to show them now? You know, there's guys out there who are leading, but they're going to be going into the pits and who knows what the order is going to be like. And so it's kind of hard to judge, you know, how Barros got his... I mean, he's a great racer, so, and he's actually very good in the wet. So he may have very well made up a lot of spots simply just through hard work on the track.
Right, exactly. And the thing is,
we don't know.
Right. But still, whatever. Ended up finishing eighth. Nicky Hayden finishing ninth. Hayden didn't have a very good race. He really didn't. Just, you know, things weren't working out. 10th spot was John Hopkins, another guy that pretty much had a miserable weekend all around. I mean, just they didn't seem to get it at Motegi or Suzuki, especially after such a great performance in the last couple of races. He did manage to beat teammate Chris Vermeulen, who came in 11th, so that puts Hopkins even further ahead in points compared to Vermeulen. And then probably the sort of star, or not star, but the oh my gosh finish of the race was 12th spot went to Valentino Rossi, and that was all due to that second pit.
Actually, Tamada finished before ahead of him.
In 12th. Oh, did I miss one? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right, I did.
the star Tamada.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that Tamada has been a little bit easy to forget this year.
And he has a great record at Motegi, so it's kind of a shame.
Right. And, you know, but again, in a home track, Japanese rider, all that sort of thing, so it kind of...
He was top Japanese.
Say again?
He was the top Japanese.
Yes, he was. You know, Tamada had that kind of race going on. So 13th spot, let's get it right, Bob. I mean, the lap chart, the finishing chart's not that far away. Valentino Rossi, and here is the kind of another interesting sort of statistic or trivia or whatever you want to call it about the race, is that he was followed one position only behind him by his teammate Colin Edwards, which is probably one of the closest finishes between Edwards and Rossi that you're going to, you know, get.
Ouch.
yeah, I know, but it's been brutal for Edwards this year.
Yeah,
it really has. Yeah. Then 15th spot, Shinichi Ito. You know, hey, finished the race, got a point. That's kind of cool. You know, what the hell? Did better than Shinya Nakano, who finished in 16th. Then Yanagawa, wild card in 17th. And Carlos Checa, circulating last, finishing in 18th. Considering that this was a wet race, we didn't have as many actual DNFs as you might expect. Mm-hmm. But we did have Akiyoshi, who DNF'd with bike troubles. He was actually racing a good race.
Yeah.
And probably, yeah, would have done quite well.
He would have beaten the other Suzuki guys.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm looking at the lap chart here real quick. What position was he in when he retired? He was up in fifth.
Yeah. No, he was looking to beat the regular Suzuki riders.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so that would have been really cool news for him, but unfortunately was not to be. You know, variety of different issues.
I think Paul Denning has a little remote switch saying, okay, this is going to look bad.
Is that what
so
it is?
Press the button.
Yeah.
oh, bike trouble, sorry.
Curtis, other retirements was, you know, Curtis Roberts had retired early on. Not sure of any details on that. Why? Did you catch anything?
No, but I think earlier when you were saying that he was the first guy to pit to change tires, I think he pitted and never came out.
Oh, I thought he came back out on slicks.
Did he? I don't think so. I think he pitted and that was it.
Oh, yeah. You know, he was done. You're right. Because he finished on just a couple laps into it.
Yeah.
Huh. And then Danny Pedrosa had the only spectacular crash of the race.
Ugh, and that would look bad.
Oh, man, it did. Yeah. I'm surprised. You know, there is some talk about an injury and stuff. Apparently, he thought he fractured his foot or his ankle or something along those lines. But fortunately for him, it's not a fracture.
Yeah.
Take it?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't know if you read that, it's actually not a fracture.
Right. Some kind of arthritis that just, you know, how the hell does arthritis just crop up all of a sudden and then goes away or whatever, but, you know, something along those lines where, you know, lots and lots of pain, but, you know, give him some anti-inflammatories and sort of, you know, try to stay off of that and you should be fine, sort of a situation. So, and that was, like I said, being a wet race, you know, remarkably few of the low sides that you typically see in a wet race. It was an interesting one. It really was. It was one for the record books in some ways because of its unusualness. And it would be interesting to see Julian Ryder's write up for it next year. After the season.
In the review, you mean?
GP review. Say again?
In his review book?
Yes, in his review book.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which was amazing. And it was actually really awesome to be able to see the Ducati team celebrating when Stoner came in.
Yeah, they
even
did.
Though he didn't. There was this hilarious moment where the team was running out and they didn't know. Okay, should we go to the podium because our guy won, or should we be going to the garage where the champion is going to be? Right. It's like,
right.
You know, who goes where?
Yeah, a little bit difficult. And actually, MotoGP, the website, MotoGP.com, I think had that same difficult decisions to make and stuff. It's like, do we feature Pedrosa or not Pedrosa. Do we feature Stoner having because he won the championship, or do we feature Caparossi and all of that?
Right.
And they tend to go with the championship. So Stoner has it locked up. He could skip the next three races for whatever reason, and he'd still be world champion for 2007 in MotoGP. But
I think we're going to see some great racing from him now.
I think so, too. He's going to be relaxed, and it's just like, you know.
They're all going to be, actually. It's all over.
Yes, so, they are. Yeah, I agree.
It's going to be great.
Well, Pedrosa and Rossi might have a little bit of a battle going on for second. There might be some kind of skirmishing going on
there. That's true.
Because that one is still actually out for
it's still doable, but it's going to be tough for Pedrosa.
Yeah, 26 points. But, I mean, the way Rossi's been having, the kind of season that Rossi's been having lately, 26 points over three races is entirely doable for Pedrosa.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Pedrosa's been relatively consistent-ish, and Rossi has just been all over the map lately. So between DNFs and all of that sort of thing. So I think maybe that might be something that will affect Pedrosa more than Rossi. Because frankly, if I was Rossi, it's like, you know, if I don't win the championship,
Rossi should be pretty happy that Danny has had three DNFs this year, because he may not even be second.
Exactly, that's true.
And the thing is that aside from this one, Pedrosa's other two DNFs were because somebody else plowed into him, so who knows?
Yeah, that's true. Let's see, Australia, Malaysia, and Valencia. I'm sure Valencia is going to be a strong Pedrosa track. Can't recall quite on Australia and Malaysia what, you know, his sort of... Everybody likes Australia. They all say they love Australia.
Yeah.
So, you know, Phillip Island is not like something. But Malaysia is kind of an oddball out of there. And Pedrosa might be miserable or not. Huh. Fourth and fifth in the championship, you still got Hopkins and Vermeulen. So the Suzuki guys, I mean, they got a lot to sort of crow about there.
Yeah.
That they've got two guys in the top five. That's good.
Vermeulen's staying at Suzuki, and Hopkins is leaving. So Hopkins probably wants to finish ahead. You know, this is his last chance.
I think he does. Yeah. He wants to sort of show that he's a real racer, and he's on et cetera, all that good stuff. So I think, you know, we don't need to necessarily go down the rest of the championship order.
But it's just interesting to note that Melandri's also like in that fight for fourth.
Yes, sorry, yeah, I didn't mean to knock Melandri, but no, I mean they're all actually. But from there, what you got? Six. Marco Melandri is on 148 points, and John Hopkins in fourth is 156. That's an 8-point gap.
Yep.
You know, that's pretty much where you're. You know, if you want to have the guy, I finished fourth in the championship. You know, that's one of your battles right there. That's super close. And yeah, that you could be anybody's rate, or well, anybody's fourth at that point. Loris Caparossi seventh, Nicky Hayden eighth. He's picking up a little bit. Is kind of somewhat coming up. Japan, put a dent in his point progression because he put 112 points. He's 18 points behind Caparossi, and how many points? 36 points behind Melandri in sixth. So, you know, mathematically, yes, it's possible he could move up to the top five even, which I had said earlier on that I thought he would finish in the top five. But, he ain't gonna. Not now. I mean, if he's lucky, he'll pick up seventh.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, if he's lucky, he'll keep eighth. And, you know, just a miserable miserable season for Hayden coming off of his world championship. But that's not the first time that's happened. So it's just the way racing is. It really is. So, in any event, I know you got a kind of boogie.
I have one more thing I wanted to mention.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. So I was catching up on some of the episodes that I missed, and you were talking to Toby Moody two shows ago, and he mentioned his website, the other website where he writes for, which is autosport.com. There's an amazingly interesting article on there that just popped up yesterday. About Ducati choosing Bridgestone to beat Rossi. Have you seen this thing?
No, I haven't seen it. Oh, I haven't read that.
It's very cool. So Claudio Domenicali, basically said that they specifically opted for Bridgestone tires because they needed to have something they opted for the. Here's what it says: he opted for Bridgestone tires because they knew it would be difficult to beat Valentino Rossi without a technical advantage.
Very interesting thing
to say, considering that. Also yesterday, Casey Stoner came out and said that, hey, it's not about the tires. Give our guys some credit. And then the CEO of Ducati is like plugging Bridgestone. So it's very, very, very interesting story.
Yeah.
I'll send you a link so you can put it up for the listeners to read this article. I think it's worth reading. It's very short, but it's...
I will. On Autosport now, a lot of Autosport is pay. So is that... But I guess we can't...
I was able to get to it, so... I'll send you the link.
Yeah, we will put that link up there because it's great stuff. Toby Moody obviously is brilliant, you know. And
it wasn't Toby Moody actually that wrote this article. He pointed out that site. I decided I'd put an RSS feed on it.
Right.
That popped up.
Okay, because we got the Stoner. We deserve more credit. And then what the other Ducati chose Bridgestone.
Yeah.
So okay. We will put those links.
Well, they've been
up,
on Bridgestone for a few seasons, but you know,
right. That's interesting stuff. That's kind of cool and a little bit different than what we've been hearing in like some ways. Well, you know, the Stoner line is more along the lines of what we've been hearing. But
yeah,
all right. In any event, why don't we go ahead and say goodbye? And it was fun. We've got Phillip Island coming up, one of the best races of the season. Always, it's always good for great racing, and that is coming up on October 14th, the weekend of October 12th, 13th, and 14th, which I have a dentist appointment on 12th as well. Jeez.
And I'll be seeing you next week at the track.
Yes, you will. Exactly. I hadn't mentioned that too much, that Jules and I we're going to be doing a track day. Darren Carpenter, listener, and some of his friends and things from the Omer Racing Series up there in Portland, a bunch of us from like Oregon up in the Piney Woods. And we're all going to be traveling down to California, down to Jules's neck of the woods kind of a thing, even though it's not really woods. And we're going to be doing a track day down there at Thunder Hill, a two-day track day. I'm doing full 2 days. So, we're going to see Jules. It's going to be great times. If we get a chance, we might do a little bit of recording and things or something. I don't know. A lot of times those things don't tend to work out because we're down there to enjoy the track day and have fun and concentrate on the things you do at a track day, which for me is improve my riding skills and stop being a chicken. For other people, it might be a variety of things. But whatever it is, we'll see what we do, and we will talk a little bit about it one way or the other in the next show.
And I do want to mention that I'm bringing Bridgestones. It's the first time I'll be riding Bridgestones on the track, and I figured that that's my little way of showing support for the team, for their incredible effort this year.
And that's cool. I'm always a huge fan of support your racing sponsors. Buy Corona beer, buy Marlboro cigarettes if you smoke.
Man, if they made a KR tuned pipe for my 916, I'd be getting one. But
there
they don't.
There you go. I mean, yeah. And there is, and that's a fact, actually. I mean, these guys advertising your sport, you should support them to a point. But in any event, let's go ahead and say goodbye here, Jules. It was great talking to you. Kind of a rush show, but still good stuff.
See you next week.
See ya.
On Tuesday, September 25th, a short article appeared on the Autosport.com MotoGP feed that I think is really incredibly interesting and amazingly revealing about Ducati's motivation to move to Bridgestone back in 2004, which culminated in the 2007 championship. This article states that Ducati Corsa CEO Claudio Domenicali revealed that the decision to go to Bridgestone in 2004 was specifically because they knew they could not beat Valentino Rossi without a technical advantage. So what follows are a few choice quotes from the article and a lot of conjecture from me, but please read the article and let us at MotoGPOD know what you think. If you recall, at the end of the 2003 season, we began hearing rumors of Rossi leaving Honda. That he was going to leave slowly became clear, but where he was going was still a mystery. And although Rossi soon revealed that his intention was to go to Yamaha, rumors persisted that Ducati was desperately trying to get the doctor to ride the Desmosedici. And as Rossi revealed in his autobiography, these rumors were true. He was, in fact, approached by Ducati, but in the end declined the Italian manufacturer's advances because he felt that they were too much like Honda, all about the bike and not enough about the rider. He felt that by going to Yamaha, he would be in a better position to, with Jeremy Burgess, direct the design decisions of the M1. As we now know, it was a perfect storm, and Rossi and the M1 took back-to-back championships, starting with the very first race Rossi rode on the M1 at the start of the 2004 season, the brilliant victory at Velcom, South Africa. Ducati, meanwhile, went to the Bridgestone tire. At the time, it was a very surprising and costly move, as after a brilliant season in 2003, 2004 was not as kind to the team, and 2005 even less so. Only in 2006 did the Desmosedici-Bridgestone combination begin to show its true potential. Domenicali says, "That was the result of some reasoning. We had a huge admiration for Rossi. We had tried to sign him, but we didn't manage to. Having thought that it would have been difficult to beat him in the same technical conditions, Livio Suppi, had an idea that has turned out to be a winner, to face him with different weapons, that is, different tires." So basically, Ducati teamed up with Bridgestone and began developing a package with the explicit purpose of beating Valentino Rossi. Now, this wasn't a vendetta. Ducati wasn't going after Rossi for personal reasons. They just wanted to win the championship. But in their way, as always, was Rossi. And this was their answer. And now, 3 years later, that gamble, Livio's winner idea, culminates in the championship going to Casey Stoner and Ducati and Bridgestone. The perfect storm, as Bob Hayes likes to call it, is no accident. It was an extremely well-executed long-term strategy. I don't know about you, but I found this to be very illuminating and fascinating. It is an amazing story of long-term planning, technical wizardry, sacrifices, and overwhelming success in the end. Very, very well played, Ducati.
All right, that's going to do it for today's show. Although I have been officially forbidden to apologize, I do want to say about the audio quality that that won't happen again. I'm not going to let that one happen, and I hope that the call was still understandable even with the audio problems there and everything else. I thought it was interesting enough that I wanted to keep it, so we just sort of rode through it and bore with it and all of that. So next week, I've got a track day like we talked about in that call. We'll be doing some stuff. I've got a couple of things planned. Might be kind of a quick show because I'll be getting back home on that Thursday. I've got a long drive down there, then 2 days track day, Tuesday and Wednesday, and then I'll probably be driving back home on Thursday. So I won't have a lot of time to prepare for next week's show, but I do have a couple of things in the can. I think you're going to like it next week, so make sure you tune in. And until then, have a good week, and we will talk to you later. One thing that you can always count on about MotoGP OD is that there will be the little disclaimer at the end, and that I'll try to make it slightly less boring by maybe trying to make it funny. Whether or not it's funny is entirely up to the listener. However, please bear with me when I tell you that MotoGP OD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL, and the MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD.com is not affiliated with any of them. I actually threw in another extra .com. I was just going to say MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them, but because I'm sort of reading this and rambling on and on, got .com kind of thrown in there. So this you could listen to over and over again if you wanted to go to sleep, because it's a little bit of lawyerese that we throw in here at the end of the show to say that MotoGPOD is produced by me and that Dorna doesn't sort of even acknowledge my existence.